The following podcast is part of the MindBodySpirit.fm podcast network. Are you longing for a place where hope, ideas, and new ways of thinking can arise? For nearly 50 years, Omega Institute's campus in Rhinebeck, New York, has been a gathering place where world-class teachers provide innovative educational experiences that cultivate extraordinary potential in us all. Join us, either on campus or online. To learn more, visit eomega.org.
Support for this show comes from 1440 Multiversity, a state-of-the-art learning destination in the California Redwoods near Santa Cruz. 1440 Multiversity offers weekend and five-day programs in mindfulness, leadership, well-being, and more. Learn more at 1440.org.
From Spirituality and Health magazine, this is Essential Conversations. Our guest today is Dr. Mark Epstein. Dr. Epstein is a psychiatrist in private practice in New York City and the author of a number of books about the interface of Buddhism and psychotherapy, including Thoughts Without a Thinker, Going to Pieces Without Falling Apart, Going on Being, Open to Desire and Psychotherapy Without the Self. His newest work is The Trauma of Everyday Life. An interview with Dr. Epstein appears in the March-April issue of Spirituality and Health magazine. Mark Epstein, welcome to Essential Conversations.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, I'm very excited about talking to you. I have been a, I don't know if I say student or follower of yours since 92 with the publication of Thoughts Without a Thinker. You are a major contributor to the way I understand not just psychology, but Buddhism. You're also Jewish, and this is Passover week, and we don't normally date these interviews, but this is the middle of Passover. And I'm a rabbi who spent years practicing Zen, so I have to ask you, just as a way of opening this, what drew you to Buddhism? Do you integrate Buddhism with your Judaism? Do you have any connection with Judaism?
Well, my connection with Judaism is pretty fragile. So I came to Buddhism. I grew up in an academic family. I always say that academia was the religion that I was given at birth. So it was kind of devoid of any kind of spiritual context. So I think Buddhism came to me freshly, and I was drawn to, there's something about it, talking about that the mind could bring itself to some kind of peace that drew me in right away. And I found it in college, and I took an Introduction to World Religion class in my freshman year in college, and the Buddhist stuff started to work its way into me at that point.
I think that's how a lot of it started. For me, it was in high school, but the same thing. It was an Introduction to World Religions. And when we got to the Buddhist section, it's like, oh my God, that makes so much sense.
Yeah, so, it really did right away. And then, and then the deeper I got into it, it continued to make sense. So that was very exciting for me.
So one other question on this, if you have an opinion. Why do you think so many Jews, I mean, my teachers and friends in Buddhism, I mean, Philip Kaplow was my first Zen teacher, Bernie Glassman, Sharon Salzman, Jack Kornfield, Sylvia Bornstein, Lama Suridas, Genpo Roshi, Norm Fisher. I mean, these are all Jewish people who are practicing Buddhists. You think is that an accident? That can't be an accident. What's your...
That's probably an accident. There were so many Jews who were psychoanalysts also. Like, what was that about? I think in some way, historically, the Jews were always moving between cultures, and they were always the translators. So I think, if you take a historical view, it probably makes sense that the Jews are a little bit on the fringe, and they're looking to the new, and they're trying to understand their own minds, But I think, if you look at Buddhism in the West, there are equal, if not more, non-Jews who were also instrumental in introducing Buddhism. So I think it's a little bit of a red herring, although, it's a provocative question. I think, the other thing is that for many of us, born Jewish in America, the religious, the spiritual aspect of Judaism was not so apparent. The, you know, the cultural aspect was there, but there's a kind of void around the spiritual aspect, and Buddhism fits nicely. You know, there's no God you have to worry about, and it's all about working with your own mind. And that dovetails nicely with psychoanalysis, which was already called the Jewish science, you know, so that's right. Where my work comes in.
Well, that makes sense to me. And the fact that you called it a red herring, and, you know, herring and Jews go together. So that's another, I'm sure that was a Freudian slip on
your part. And red is communist. How come so many Jews were communists also?
That's right. I thought of that too. And I just was trying to stay away from the communist angle, but stick with the herring, but I'll take it. And that's a good way to start the conversation. So thanks for indulging me in that. But let's move on to your new book, The Trauma of Everyday Life. It struck me, and we'll see if I'm on target with this, that what you did in this book, you were using the word trauma, it seemed to me, mm-hmm. right? That you're using the word trauma the way the Buddha used the word dukkha. Is that fair? I mean, can you tell us a little bit about if there is a connection?
You know, the word dukkha is usually translated as suffering. I always think about it more as unsatisfactoriness. But the actual word dukkha, if you take it apart, it means hard to face. So the Buddha was saying in his First Noble Truth that there's something about life or aspects of life that is hard to face. And then he talked about separation and loss and old age and illness and death and so on. So I was definitely superimposing trauma onto that concept of dukkha, specifically because what I was moved by in starting the book was this little talked about fact, if we can call it a fact, that the Buddha's mother was purported to have died when he was just a week old. And no one had ever made anything of that in my experience. But I started to wonder, why was that part of the story? And was there some kind of hidden psychological message there, that there was something hard to face about the Buddha's early life that relates to our focus on early experience as determining the kind of suffering or traumas that we're all dealing with in an everyday way.
So I had not heard that story before, but I had heard the story that the Buddha left his wife and son and went out to face life right after the baby was born. So do you see
exactly. So yes, so that's always a disturbing thing. Like, you know, when we hear the Buddha's story, and why did he leave the nice wife, and how could he abandon the son, and what kind of person is that? But if you look at it as that, actually he's replicating a kind of trauma that occurred to him when he was too young to actually be able to cognize, you know, or have thoughts about what the hell had happened to him. There he is acting out, or in our language, enacting the same trauma that he was subjected to. Then there's a kind of psychobiography aspect of the Buddhist story that starts to emerge that I think is relevant, you know, not just for what we call the big T traumas of, you know, war and rape and car accidents and so on, but also the little T traumas, the more everyday traumas of children who don't have an optimal home environment to grow up in, or never learn how to deal with their anger or their feelings of abandonment or whatever it might be. So I thought that story of the Buddha's mother, you know, being ripped away when he was just a baby is important in understanding his whole journey.
So how, well, first of all, now we know the title of your next book is Buddha on the Couch.
No, that's an old rejected title. The title of my next book is Advice Not Given.
Oh, nice. Okay.
Mm-hmm. The subtitle is a guide to getting over yourself.
Okay, which, of course, something I wanted to talk to you about was this whole notion of thoughts without a thinker. So getting over yourself when there's no self to get over, that seems to me very difficult.
It's not that there's no self to get over. It's that the self is not as real or concrete or fixed as we imagine it to be. So it's our fixed notions of self are what we have to get over. There actually is a self or a soul. We just don't know what the hell it is.
So is the self or soul? I mean, my understanding was, I mean, you know, coming from a Zen thing, they always talk about no self and no mind and anatta and all
yes.
that. But you're suggesting that it's what Sigmund Bauman might call the liquid self. It's fluid. It's emptying of its content.
Well, there's a problem with language. Anytime you make a noun out of it, it's a problem. Mm-hmm. You know, so even when you say it's a fluid self, then you're still stuck with a sort of objectified version of what it is that you are. And I think what the Zen people are getting at, you know, with know this, know that, is that, our minds trick us always into objectifying something that really is not an object. So we are not an object. And even when we talk about ourselves as a subject, you know, even calling ourselves a subject is making it an object.
Right.
So the Buddhist experience, the meditative experience of looking for the self, that then when you really look for it, you can't find it. You know, all you find is a kind of transparent feeling, you know, that you know you're there, but can you put your finger on it? And that's the kind of liberating insight that Buddhism brings. It's not that you're, you know, removed completely from who you always have been. It's that you actually connect more deeply to who or what you always have been.
So you say in Thoughts Without a Thinker, that, and I'm just going to quote a sentence here, from the Buddhist perspective, meditation is indispensable to free the individual from neurotic misery. The notion of neurotic misery, and I want to come to meditation mm-hmm. in a second. I mean, that seems to be what you're talking about, is when we take the self as a thing, when we make it, I guess there's, you might say there's self-ing, but there's no self.
Yep.
Is that key to this notion of two things, of the neurotic misery, and then is that at the heart of things that are hard to face? Is that the hardest thing to face? Go ahead.
But it's hard to quantify. Trying to quantify what the hardest thing to face is probably a fool's errand. Because the things that are hard to face are shifting, endlessly shifting, and always surprising us. And, you know, we think we've mastered separation, and then we have to deal with old age, or, you know, we think we've found love, and then we have to deal with loss. And, you know, it's just like never ending. So the idea of neurotic misery is that in neurosis, there's a kind of fixation or a kind of knot, which is a language that is a word that the Buddhists sometimes use, a kind of knot, or Wilhelm Reich would say a kind of armoring that happens around experiences or feelings that we don't quite understand, or that feel too unbearable. You know, the ego is all about preserving its sense of control. So when things happen that feel unbearable, the ego kind of unconsciously pushes that stuff away. It dissociates from the difficult feelings, and that creates a kind of neurotic knot. So in meditation, we learn how to make enough room in the mind to start to allow the unpleasant, unbearable kinds of feelings to start to reveal themselves again. And gradually, we relax around that. And that allows a kind of ease to come.
And the ease allows you to feel whatever is coming up.
Yeah,
the ease allows you.
And that, in some way, that opens the heart back up. Because the real thing, the real essential thing, you know, somewhere in that transparent self that's not as real as we think it is love. And for some reason, that's scary to people, and they shy away from it. But the point, I think, has to be that we're basically developing our capacity to love.
And do you still think that meditation is indispensable to that?
Depends how you understand meditation, of course.
So give us your take on it.
People objectify meditation and they turn meditation into something that they're straining at or striving for or get attached to in that sense of spiritual materialism. And then they're just like sitting and hurting their knees, you know, and or priding themselves on emptying their mind of thoughts when, you know, as soon as they stop meditating, they start thinking again. So what's the point of that? But the ability, whether you cultivate it in a sitting meditation or in psychotherapy or when jogging or when making art or listening to music, the ability to dispassionately observe the workings of your own mind and body, you know, not getting attached to what's pleasant and not pushing away what's unpleasant, that's meditation.
So
I do think is indispensable. Some cultivation of the mind's ability to observe itself is indispensable, yes.
So do you encourage the people you work with to try something in particular, or you just say, look, you can get it through jogging, swimming, gardening, as well as sitting?
Well, the people I work with, I encourage to keep coming back for as long as they can, as long as they find it useful, because that, you know, just having to sit here with me is a kind of meditation in that way.
Right.
And then if they're interested, you know, if they want meditation, I can guide them in that direction. But if they're not everyone, it's not for everyone. People have to find their own way. So I try to get to know people well enough to even though my next book is called Advice Not Given, to feel free enough to offer the advice that they don't have to take.
Okay, well, that's good. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, sort of.
I'm. You're looking at this from many different perspectives, but certainly the perspective of a psychologist, a psychiatrist. What about, you know, Zen or Buddhism in the brain? You know, I'm thinking of James Austin's work, where you're sort of wiring the brain and then meditating and seeing what happens when people.
Yeah.
Are doing yeah. Zen practice. How does that yeah. impact your understanding?
Not very much. My personal understanding, it has not impacted it very much. You know, I came up from the scientific background. I went to medical school. My early research was with physiologists and neurobiologists who were into measuring what was happening in the brain and in the body in various forms of meditation. So I understand how that's been extremely useful in propagating, you know, in a materialist society where we think something's real if we can see it happening on a brain scan. I think that's been very important for people to take meditation seriously. But I always saw that as sort of peripheral and secondary. I took it seriously because I could feel it made a difference for me. And the difference it was making for me, I don't think I was going to be able to like point to a physiological or neurobiological measure and say, oh yeah, that's where it is. It's much more in, you know, in my soul, so to speak. So I sort of moved away, you know, I appreciate that that's one of the things that's happening in the culture, and but it hasn't been my focus.
So that's interesting. I think, I mean, you're sort of going, a more phenomenological approach to the, I mean, you're looking at your experience as opposed to what comes up on a brain scan. And what's powerful about you saying that is that you've had the training to know what's going on if you look at the brain scan. So
yeah, I mean, our understanding of the brain is still pretty primitive, even though we're making huge advances. So the idea that we could really know, you know, the intimate details and the depth of what meditation is about. You know, we don't really even understand depression and how that works in the brain or how the drugs work in the brain. You know,
right.
No one really understands that yet. We're just at the beginning. So that's wonderful work to do. It just isn't the work that I'm doing.
Right. Well, we may be at the beginning of that understanding. We're coming near the end of this conversation, which is, and it goes very fast. So let's see if I can get at least one more question in.
Sure.
I don't know if you remember this, but back in 91, when Tricycle magazine first came out, there was this discussion in the magazine about the future of Buddhism in America. And I don't remember it was who said it, but whoever said it, they said that the future would be as a psychology. And is that how you see it going? Is that it really is this psychological aspect or how?
I think it's always been a psychology. I think it was a psychology before we had a word for psychology. That's why it's still alive and flourishing and relevant to us. So I think now we have words for psychology and, you know, the unconscious and psychoanalysis and so on. So I think that's one of the languages that Buddhism has to be translated into for it to stay of interest to us. So I do think that language is going to surround Buddhism more than maybe some of the ritual aspects that were important in the Asian cultures.
Right.
But whether it's going to be more of a psychology than it ever was, I think probably not. Its psychological depth is very real.
So in the 30 seconds we've got left, can you give our listeners a sort of a sense? So what's one thing, I hate this kind of question, but I'm going to do it anyway. What's one thing I can do to more effectively, face my traumas?
A couple of years ago, I was lecturing about this in Oklahoma City. A guy came up to me, a therapist who worked at the local VA where there's a lot of trauma. And he said, you know, I never talk about Buddhism or use the word mindfulness when I'm dealing with my patients. I just tell them, go outside, shut the door and listen. And I thought, oh, that's a beautiful way of taking it into the everyday. Really strip it of all the Buddhist stuff and just make a little space in your life to listen in a new way to the outside and the inside. So,
okay.
Just take a walk, little walk. Without the headphones.
Oh no, now that's too traumatic. without my iPhone, I don't think I can do it. Oh my God.
Without your meditation app.
Yeah, without my meditation app. This has been a fabulous conversation, Mark. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. You're very welcome. Anytime.
Well, thank you. My guest today was Mark Epstein. He's the author of The Trauma of Everyday Life. An interview with Dr. Epstein appears in the March-April issue of Spirituality and Health magazine. You can learn more about his work at markepsteinmd.com. Support for today's podcast comes from 1440 Multiversity, a state-of-the-art learning destination in the California Redwoods near Santa Cruz, offering weekend and five-day programs in mindfulness, leadership, well-being, and more. Learn more at 1440.org. And a side note, I will be at 1440 Multiversity on August 18th through the 20th, leading a workshop on my book, The Sacred Art of Loving Kindness. I hope you can join me. Essential Conversations with Rabbi Rami is a project of Spirituality and Health magazine. Please log into the spiritualityandhealth.com website and subscribe to the magazine in print or digital formats, and download the iTunes app for this podcast. Essential Conversations is produced by Ezra Baker, and our program coordinator and executive producer is Alma Tassi. I'm Rabbi Rami. Thanks for listening.